Good morning. My name is Dan Maxwell. I'm from the Feinstein International Center at Tufts University. And this is a panel on resilience in fragile contexts. I think the events of the last day or two have shown us the extent to which resilience has become the organizing framework and programming strategy for intervention in some of the most vulnerable or risk-prone environments that we deal with. But a lot of questions remain about its application in fragile contexts, which are characterized by ineffective or illegitimate governance, by weak institutions, and frequently by conflict or violent extremism. And it goes without saying that most of the daunting cases of chronic poverty, persistent vulnerability, and the reemergence of famine in the 21st century are precisely in those fragile, conflict-affected states. So this session will address the role of state building, of conflict management, and peace building, and more recent notions around countering violent extremism as components of resilience strategies. It might be best to separate out a little bit two different elements that we're talking about here, even though they overlap. One is contexts that are characterized mainly by illegitimate or ineffective or weak governance and weak institutions, and those that are affected by violent conflict. The latter, almost by definition, overlaps with the former, but the former sometimes does not necessarily overlap with the latter. To introduce us, I'd just like to reiterate a few findings from our own work at Feinstein Center and then introduce our panel. The first one is that political shocks and stressors, be they weak or illegitimate governance or outright conflict, are different from natural and environmental hazards. They are, by definition, man-made, and with only limited gender insensitivity in my calling them man-made. There are multiple drivers of vulnerability in most of these contexts, but as a community of practice around resilience, we tend to gravitate towards climatic, environmental, and in some cases, economic stressors and shocks, and tend to steer clear of political ones, of which conflict is the most common. We are frequently guilty of misdiagnosing the drivers of conflict or presume too much about the capacity to manage conflict. The role of the state is highly variable. The very definition of illegitimate governance is the inability to manage conflict. And of course, we frequently see engagement by the state in predatory actions against its own populations, or at a minimum, ignoring predation on the part of others. Both are common features in protracted crises. The role of livelihood assets that we're so fond of looking at in other contexts and are critical to resilience in climatic or environmental or economic shocks may actually be reversed in conflict or in the absence of rule of law. Assets can quickly become liabilities, making people more likely to be raided, to be looted, or to be targeted for attacks. And fourthly, conflict in these kinds of situations rarely has a clear endpoint. And despite the rhetoric, there is very frequently nothing much in the way of a quote-unquote peace dividend in the aftermath of conflict. Though conflict as an explicit shock might end, conflict as a stressor may continue for years. And the fact that conflict as both a shock and a stressor is so difficult to measure tends to mean that we underestimate its cumulative impact. Another point is that if conflict, even if it does have a clear endpoint and violent conflict actually ceases, the impact of conflict on livelihoods and on resilience can be very long-lasting. But the aid business moves on rather quickly. We've seen in numerous cases a distinct shift in a post-conflict context from a focus on the vulnerable to a focus on the viable. Who are the people that can take advantage of new technologies or market opportunities, et cetera? And the shift rapidly moves away from vulnerable people, who tend to stay that way for a very long time after conflicts. And finally, social networks are key to people's resilience in situations of protracted conflict and weak or illegitimate governance, but highly context-specific and subject to rapid change in the course of conflict and indeed induced by conflict. And external interventions are often not particularly attuned to the local nuance in this context. So these are some of the questions that we will try to address, and a couple of other ones include questions around the limits and opportunities of resilience interventions in protracted crises, in fragile contexts, where by definition at least some of the drivers of vulnerability are political. To what extent should conflict or weak governance be understood as shocks or as stressors in the usual sense implied by resilience discourse? And finally, what does the evidence suggest as ways forward on all of these questions? We have with us a distinguished panel to address some of these questions. I have here all of their details that I was going to present to you, but I realize that what I have is precisely what you have in your program, so I think rather than bore you by regurgitating what it says there, I will simply introduce the three of them and we'll have more time for discussion. So Joseph Hewitt is the Vice President for Policy, Learning, and Strategy at the U.S. Institute for Peace. John Kurtz is the Mercy Corps' Senior Director for Research and Learning, and Luca Russo is a Senior Economist at the Food and Agriculture Organization and has been instrumental in leading a number of the studies on resilience measurement. So I will ask each of the panelists in the order just introduced to address some of the key findings from their own research or their own programmatic experience, and then we'll take some questions from the floor, and I'll try to retain about 10 minutes at the end for each of the panelists to summarize sort of cumulative thoughts. So with that, Joe.
Okay, thank you. I think I should use the mic, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay. Is this on? Up here, it doesn't sound like it's on, so.
No.
All right, so there's a switch.
No, I think you're good.
I have a green light. No?
Closer?
Yeah. Oh, there we go, okay. Good morning. This is, when we talked, I think a couple weeks ago about getting organized for this, it was a recognition that I'm really not an expert on resilience. My background is a conflict expert. I'm an expert on fragility dynamics and what makes countries vulnerable to conflict. And we agreed that the best use of me is to be the table setter, to kind of frame what we mean by fragility, what we mean by when we talk about fragility dynamics, and then put a couple of issues on the table about how that connects to resilience. And then I'll be turning it over to John after that, number two, and then we'll begin to get more and more into questions about resilience programming and how that relates to fragility. So let me start here with a definition of fragility. What more and more has become the consensus definition for fragility is a condition that refers to the absence or the breakdown of a social compact between people and their government that establishes legitimate and effective interactions between them. Legitimacy and effectiveness, and Dan, in his excellent introduction, referred to those two components of fragility. Fragility is a two-dimensional concept. It depends on the presence of legitimate relations between people and their government and effective relations, and they mean two different things. Legitimacy refers to the extent to which institutions are inclusive, they are accountable to people, there's transparency, people essentially trust their government, both national and local. That's one dimension of fragility. And the other dimension, we refer to it as effectiveness. To what extent is that society able to deliver basic public goods to itself effectively, like security, health, nutrition, education, economic opportunity? When the social compact is dysfunctional in both of those ways, or even in just one of those ways, maybe it's legitimate but somewhat effective, or vice versa, the conditions exist that enable violent conflict. There is a very deep research base or evidence base that demonstrates this now, beginning with the World Development Report that came out in 2011, and then onward for the last 5 or 6 years. There's essentially agreement that almost all forms of violent conflict can be traced back to some aspect of fragility. So, what that means is that if we want to try to address the conditions that enable violence, we really need to think about what are the sources of dysfunction in state-society relations. So I only have about 5 minutes, so I just want to lay out just a couple of points about how this all might connect to resilience. And I'll say this to be maybe a little bit provocative, but I think that some of this is true. One of the things, one of the observations that I'd like to put on the table is that resilience interventions that are designed in some way to make households or individuals more resilient by creating or strengthening the kinds of livelihood assets that are important, they do not necessarily do anything to address fragility. Not necessarily. That because we're building resilience in households or individuals, that we may think we are in some way reducing conflict dynamics or reducing the risks of violence, that is not necessarily true. And as Dan pointed out, a lot of those investments can get rolled back when violence does happen, or they might actually be sources of vulnerability for populations, for individuals, and for communities. So the just building resilience itself is not necessarily a conflict prevention strategy. The key to addressing conflict or preventing conflict really has to do with transforming the politics in whatever locality we're working. We need to think about how to make political solutions to conflict more inclusive. We need to think about how to make institutions more accountable. And those are the keys to making conflict less likely. So if we're thinking about, if we're doing resilience programming in a place that's conflict affected, what should we be thinking about to connect the resilience programming to elements of fragility? You have to ask yourself questions like, to what extent does the programming that we're doing depend on a functional social compact between people and their government? To what extent does the resilience programming depend on things like government's ability to project trust, or put it the other way, the extent to which people trust their government? Or to what extent does resilience programming depend on social cohesion? Will resilience programming fail if there's a lack of social cohesion among people in that environment? To what extent does resilience programming depend on inclusive service delivery? To what extent, you know, does government actually deliver services inclusively of all people, or are some people excluded from that? In other words, asking yourself questions about to what extent does the success of some resilience investment depend on the absence of fragility or depend on the presence of a functional social compact, those kinds of questions, I think, answers to those questions, will make it more likely that the resilience programming would be successful even in an environment that's fragile. So I'll leave it like that. I'm looking forward to the discussion, and I'll turn it over to John.
Thanks, Joe. That's perfect. Now I get to proceed and kind of really probably oversimplify fragility into I guess the manifestation, as you're calling it, which is conflict of different types. Mm-hmm. And I want to take it a little bit into what do we know so far around the relationship between what we consider resilience capacities and interventions and policies and conflict dynamics. And want to answer a couple of questions through that. One is, are there things that we can do to build resilience to the effects of conflict, which is a bit short-sighted, but enabling people to cope with a major political shock like conflict. And then the other is, what Joe's getting at is, you know, are there things we know about addressing the conditions that enable violence or the root causes of conflict? So to start on the first one, I'll draw on some analysis we did in Nigeria recently, and this was with some World Bank data, sort of a panel data set for a number of years countrywide, that allowed us to look at essentially what are the factors, and I'll get through some of those, that appear to enable households over time to be able to manage, in this case, malnutrition we were looking at as a major outcome. I think yesterday there was a good case made for why looking at young outcome amongst children is important. So we're able to look at that over time for households exposed to conflict. And in Nigeria, we're talking about multiple types here. There is certainly political violence in the north and south, but also sort of communal violence in the Middle Belt and others. So we took it all kind of as a basket. And the key takeaway here was, you know, the factors that really explain resilience to those types of conflict were quite different than those that explain resilience to other shocks. So we looked at economic shocks, climate shocks, health shocks as well. And it really pointed in the direction that, that Joe was laying out in terms of what we in the jargon call transformative capacities. So it really was things like access to basic services, school, health, roads, things like trust in local government, as well as strong community institutions, mosques, churches, village groups, all these things that do go beyond an individual kind of characteristic and really depend on a, sort of a broader enabling environment. So we thought that was interesting, and as pointed out, you know, sort of distinct from the, some of the things that we've seen as important characteristics of resilience to other types of shocks. So that's a helpful distinction for us to start. The second question, though, is I think potentially more important, which is we can't take conflict or other political shocks as just a given and say, how do we help people cope, right? That's a bit kind of unethical. So trying to understand, you know, are there programming strategies that not only reduce conflict, because there's a whole field of conflict management and peace building that can speak to that, but that reduce conflict in ways that also enable households, communities to cope with other types of shocks. And here our best data point was actually one of the original studies we did getting into the resilience racket back in 2011 in Ethiopia, where we were looking at a natural resource management conflict program in southern Ethiopia, which was not designed to build resilience at all, but in the face of the 2011 drought there, we did see some stark differences between where we were able to create conditions of more stability and freedom of movement, those people not surprisingly being able to fare better in terms of the access to resources that they use to kind of cope and adapt livelihoods. But looking a little bit underneath that, we were trying to understand a little bit more around the mechanisms that would explain that or the reasons. And it actually did really come back to what we would call local governance, and in this case, kind of connections between traditional authorities and what was a decentralized power structure of the government there in terms of who develops peace agreements, who reinforces them, how engaged are communities in this natural resource management sharing. So pointing back to some of the similar factors there in my mind. And then I guess the last thing that I wanted to bring up, and this is more of a question, I think, for the group, which is, and this is one that we get a lot, which is, you know, what are the prerequisites to even thinking about intervening within a resilience approach in a truly fragile state? So are there sort of foundational conditions of stability, of you know, government willingness, of social cohesion to be able to invest in that way? It seems like some of the same things that we see as important to build are the exact things that are lacking in truly fragile states. So there's a bit of a paradox in a South Sudan or, you know, even places in Somalia where we want to push that agenda, but I think we have to ask some hard questions of, would we be wasting money in a place where maybe that kind of longer-term thinking and approaches really might not be viable?
Yeah. Okay, I work for the FAO, which is the Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, so I will try to pitch my presentation around resilience, agriculture, conflict and fragility. Dan and I, in 2010, we are the two main editors of the State of Food Insecurity Report on food insecurity in protracted crisis, and which show that in protracted crisis situation, the food security situation is normally three times as worse than in the other developing country. And with Dan, we really struggle to do some classification, no? How much of this context is fragile, how much is conflict, how much is governance, because we wanted to do some categorization, then we gave up, because it was just impossible. The things were too much intermingled. Now, and the resilience agenda at that time was not so prominent, although I would say that the things we wrote in that report, they were quite consistent with many of the things we have been saying in the last 6 or 7 years around resilience. The report was in 2010. Now, I will start with the conclusion, then I will bring the evidence. And the evidence is based on three case study. One is in northern Mali, that which was presented by Marco Delrico this morning about the impact on resilience of the conflict in northern Mali, Syria, and the conflict in Syria, and then Abyei, which is a contested area between South Sudan and Sudan. So what kind of conclusion, as an organization that deals with agriculture, we have come up? The first conclusion is that, of course, conflict and fragility have a huge impact on agriculture, huge impact. I will quote a few figures based on the evidence. The second one, we need to advocate for a protection agenda for agriculture. Agriculture needs to be protected in this kind of fragile context. The third element is that this sort of fragility offers also an opportunity, and agriculture can play a role in reconstructing the social fabric, which is so important in the case of fragility, and I will talk about this when I'm talking about ABA. And the fourth element is the need to have a stronger knowledge agenda on these topics. So these are the four points that I would like to make. Syria. In Syria, we have estimated, we did a survey with over 3,500 households, and we come up with a number of conclusions which can be of interest. The impact of the conflict on agriculture has been, the cost is, can be estimated to $17 billion. That is the cost of the conflict in Syria on agriculture. And agriculture, despite some perception, is still quite important in Syria. I mean, about 6.7 million people live essentially out of agriculture, and it represents 26% of GDP. Now, our survey tells us a number of things. No? First of all, that 75% of the people we interview were still growing their own food, and for 90% of the household, 90% of the household were depending, they spend at least 50% of their income on food. But what is happening in Syria is that the agriculture sector, also in terms of humanitarian response, has been neglected. And the point is, and there's been a number of discussions with households and so on, is that by continuing neglecting the sector, the situation will continue to worsen, and the cost of reconstructing will continue to increase. 94% of the households there and the community said that the conflict and the lack of investment in agriculture is one of the main factors causing out-migration. So that is something very important. So the idea of having a protection agenda for agriculture. Now, Abyei. Abyei is a contested region between South Sudan and Sudan, and in when there was the peace agreement in 2011, they failed to reach an agreement on that area. And because they failed to reach an agreement on that area, which is oil rich, by the way, let's say the local politics has been further, the tension in local politics has been further heightened by the political agenda of the two countries. So on the one hand, you have the Misiria from Sudan, and the Dinkan Ngok from South Sudan. Conflict over natural resources. This is something which is, in a fragile context, have an explosive effect. So what we did as FAO, I mean, we are not a peacekeeping agency. So what we did is essentially to use agriculture as an entry point for doing and simulating inter-community dialogue. Veterinary service. We enter with the excuse of veterinary service, which were provided both to the Misteria and the Dinka, and this is the starting point of an inter-community dialogue to try to address much long-term issues around natural resource management. The results are extremely encouraging. Staff who are of Dinka origin can do vaccination in the Misteria area with no fear of attempt. So this has been something which has been extremely important. So trying to use agriculture to reconstruct the social fabric in a region. Now, coming to the knowledge agenda, that is extremely important. I mean, sometimes we fail to understand the dynamics and the links between conflict, natural resources, fragility, food security. And unless you understand these dynamics, there is a risk that our intervention will might also how to say make it even more severe, more severe the situation. And the same with food security. Understand the link between fragility and food security is a fundamental agenda. So we need to understand this thing better and making sure that our intervention are informed by this knowledge agenda. Thank you.
Okay, great, thanks. Let me have the...
We are all good, but good, I'm keeping the time. Huh?
Yeah, actually, we have done a good job of keeping time. So, a couple of observations there, a couple of slightly different definitions, but all revolving around the same key themes, and several examples of interventions and the kinds of things that can be expected from those interventions, and a lot of questions around what arises out of them. What I'd like to do now is open it to the floor. I think let's take about 25 minutes for questions, and then I'll give all three of the panelists a chance to summarize some thoughts as we go along. In the far back, yeah, is that Rowan? Yeah. And we'll take maybe three questions, and then we'll go back to the panel.
Hi, thanks everyone for your excellent insights. This question is actually directed at Luca. When it came to agriculture and conflict, did you look at all at the heterogeneity, whether there were heterogeneous effects when it came to crops? I'm thinking specifically because when we talk about the effect of weather shocks like drought and flood, we're always talking about, well, some crops are more vulnerable than others, but there is some historical precedent to say that, say, for example, if you're growing wheat versus potatoes, one is much more vulnerable to the effect of conflict than the other. So did you look at that, or is there any insights in that direction?
Thanks. And can I just remind people to introduce themselves and say where they're from?
Oh, sorry. I'm Erwin Kleppenberg, a PhD candidate.
Thanks. A couple up here in the front.
Hi, I'm Emily Gish with USAID's Office of War and Disaster Assistance. I wanted to just, maybe it's not even a question, maybe a comment, we'll see if a question comes out at the end. I wanted to point out or appreciate the importance that was mentioned of transformative capacities. Some of the research that was done on joint OCDC for peace and USAID project in Somalia also mentioned, or kind of that was one of the clear findings of baseline. And then your point on prerequisites or preconditions for a resilience program to actually work. If you could maybe just discuss more starting a traditional livelihoods or social safety net program isn't going to be the most impactful, what should people be investing in?
So nice try, John. You tried to get the audience to answer your question, but it got pushed back to you.
Thank you. Andre Mershon with the Center for Resilience at USAID, and I want to follow up a little bit on Emily's question. I thought the framing was really interesting, and I think, Joe, you mentioned kind of the importance of the breakdown of that social compact, and John, you mentioned that perhaps what people need to be resilient to conflict isn't the same thing they need to be resilient to other things, and maybe, Joe, you mentioned that those resources that people might obtain in a traditional approach, may not serve them well if there's a conflict that breaks out. Most of the places we've done resilience programs to date, these are fundamental, fragile environments, both environmentally but also politically. And you could argue that if the social compact isn't broken, it certainly is frayed in most of the places that we've worked. Mm-hmm. However, you're both telling me that perhaps an approach to resilience and conflict is perhaps a different approach than the kind of standard resilience approach. So at what point, or is there a way to do this all as one big package, or at what point do we kind of switch over and say, hey, there's more of a likelihood of a conflict, or the situations become more serious? And we work in some zones that are very fluid, like Northern Mali, for example. It's highly questionable whether in conflict or not one day or the other. And so how do we kind of balance those things, since you're telling us that the approaches might actually be fundamentally different?
Why don't we give the panelists a chance to address those, and then we'll take some more. So I think there's basically one question for each of you, or maybe one that John and Joe want to, but go ahead.
Okay, I will start with the first question. It's about the impact of on what kind of agriculture production and the conflict. I was talking about Syria, in which we have a quite solid survey. In Syria, and you can download the report. It's called Counting the Cost. We look really at where was the impact. There was a 50%, more or less 50% share between agriculture and livestock. And the main reason, when you come to agriculture, the main reason of the drop in production were due to the destruction of infrastructure. That was the main reason. And then market failure, the access to inputs which dramatically decreased, the increase of cost of fuel and so on. In other contexts, and on this you are right, the point is that particularly in case of forced displacement, then it's clear that the crops are the most affected because people cannot move. The crops cannot move, and livestock sometimes can move with the people who are displaced. But I think it's really context specific. You have to go case by case.
Sure. Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it. Okay. Thanks, Emily. I think maybe I can't give preconditions. I think that's not an empirical question, right? But I could think about what are realistic expectations in different places, and you all can help. So for me, resilience is often trying to figure out, okay, what are the systems that people depend on in these times of disturbance? And you certainly have sort of localized social systems that are usually like the first port of call. Those, I think arguably could be strengthened anywhere, and especially in places where they are afraid. You've got, I guess, ecological systems. So I'm assuming in places in Somalia, you could have a sufficient access to work on, natural resource management, ag, issues, things like that. I think where it starts to taper off in terms of doability is looking at governance and political systems. Again, if there's either an inability or an unwillingness in certain contexts, let's look at Syria or potentially Yemen. I don't think any amount of pulling, governance in, even how local, depending on how local it is, is necessarily going to come about anytime soon. But I guess that's sort of how I would start to break it down in my mind, and maybe there is some kind of a framework we can put together that sort of accumulates those types of criteria and helps to influence investment decisions. But maybe the sort of the most more basic point is, I guess resilience is not a binary thing. So if we're saying there'd be incremental resilience towards being able to, even cope a little bit better with the conflict in South Sudan is worth investing in. It's certainly not going to look like what we're able to do in northern Kenya, but we go in recognizing that is the way to think about it. You want to take Andre's question?
Okay. Yeah, I'll try to take on Andre's question. It's a really good one. It's a really hard one. I guess I'll start with this. I mean, Andre, you made the really good point that, most of the places that we're doing resilience programming are fragile or they're conflict affected. Dan made the very helpful distinction between the places where we work where there's already violence, groups are already mobilized to fight. And then there are other places that are fragile, but fighting has yet to happen. The dynamics that create the possibility of fighting are really there, and we can't ignore them. So how do we work in these places? And I would say, first of all, I'll start with a practical point, and then maybe I'll circle back to the example that Luca had. Practically, this is going to sound very simple, but staff your teams with a conflict expert. Go into the environments that you work and understand the conflict dynamics there, and assess them in terms of what's likely to happen in terms of violence, and rely on a conflict expert on your team to help with those insights, so that you better understand how your interventions that you're designing connect to those fragility and conflict dynamics. So Andre was asking, what do we do differently? One thing is just staff yourselves to be equipped to better understand the conflict dynamics in those places. The point I made in my intro was that too often a lot of the investments we make in resilience really don't have the potential to change conflict dynamics in some meaningful way. But Luca's example about Abiye is an example about where there is, they created an opportunity to change conflict dynamics by introducing a dialogue process that had potential to alter, if I understand it right, institutions that manage natural resources. That sounds like a dynamic that was creating some grievance, at least among one group, and that needed to be addressed. If ongoing work to improve agriculture programming was going to be successful. The bottom line so often is that if you are able to combine, or I'll use the word integrate programming or activities that address conflict and fragility dynamics into your larger resilience efforts, the results of those resilience efforts will be better. They'll be stronger, they'll be more durable, they'll be more likely to persist even if there is an outbreak of violence. But if you go forward without accounting for conflict dynamics or fragility dynamics, simply with a blind eye, those investments are more likely to be rolled back. And so it really is a story about how to make your resilience investments more durable and more likely to persist after violence will break out. And if you're working in a fragile environment, you just have to assume it will. Because what we know about fragility dynamics is that they are the almost like a necessary condition for creating violence. So that's how I would go at trying to respond to Andre's question.
Great, thanks. I saw a few more hands here, and then Tanya, and...
I just had a question for Luca.
Could you remind us of your name?
My name is Scott Dauberson. I'm with the Saha Regional Office in USA. In Sudan, when you worked with the organizations, how did you choose the organizations, and then who facilitated sort of the dialogue? How did it sort of work? Mm-hmm.
Hi, Tanya Boudreau, the Food Economy Group. I just had a quick point of information, not really a question, which is that I believe that in 2005 or 2006, USA actually came out with a conflict toolkit and livelihoods, which was sort of directly response to a number of these programming questions about how to program in livelihoods assistance, which I know isn't exactly completely resilience, but just so that we're all aware of that, don't repeat the same discussions.
That's good.
Any other questions?
No, please a comment.
Okay, Courtney.
It was just, I guess, a bit of a comment, but just whenever I go down the sort of rabbit hole of trying to figure out resilience in fragile contexts, I always end up in the spot of this is really systemic, and then how do we start to get at the root causes of conflict? And I just think it's kind of interesting because it then really shows up. You're then in a space of like, you know, the humanitarian, we get this tension between the humanitarians and the development workers, and it really gets highlighted when you start to talk about fragility, because dealing with reducing the impact means you have to deal with really entrenched root causes, which pulls you right out of what a humanitarian would consider their work. So it was just an observation that I think there's a lot of tension in this space around that. And I don't know how that influences the conversation.
So I guess one specific question to Luca. I don't know if the other two of you have a comment on either Tanya or Courtney's. Anyway, Luca.
No. In ABA, the key in ABA was a young and anthropologist who spent there working for us about 3 years, coming to Juba once every 3 or 4 months. But the point was there, I think we did work with local institutions. When I say local institution, I talk of the existing government service, both from Sudan and South Sudan, even if weak, but we work through them in terms of delivery of agricultural service. and then using the traditional institution, the traditional leaders, both from the Miseria and Dinka as the institutional entry point for our work in that region.
Did either of you guys want to comment on this?
Yeah, I want to take a crack at what Courtney raised. Courtney? But first, thank you for mentioning the toolkits from USAID. Yes, they're good, and I used to work at USAID, and I had a role in some of those. They're a great resource. So thank you for that plug. On the question about humanitarians and that tricky space of working on root causes of conflict, there is no doubt that if we were to ask humanitarian actors to do more to address root causes of conflict, we would go into a space that would potentially ask humanitarian actors to be political. So I'll just state it in that kind of bald terms, right? And it's unavoidable, because almost always the sources of armed conflict have a political dimension to them. So, for example, if the problem in a particular locality is the absence of social cohesion between two ethnic groups, that absence of social cohesion has, as at least one of its main causes, some kind of political dimension. Government has perhaps, for whatever reasons, favored one group over another. Or maybe other institutions of that country have favored one group over another. Maybe market institutions have favored one group over another. And those are the root causes of that dysfunctional relationship between those two ethnic groups. And if the solution is to somehow build social cohesion between them, that solution has to include some kind of inclusive political settlement that addresses that problem, that thing that is driving that grievance between that one group might have with respect to the other. So how can a humanitarian actor do that? Well, for starters, what a humanitarian actor can do is have awareness that the dynamic exists, and to deliver humanitarian assistance in a way that does not reinforce whatever is wrong. Although I think humanitarian actors are getting much, much better at this, but still, that's a problem that humanitarian actors could inflame unintentionally by not being aware of that kind of dysfunction that might exist. So certainly humanitarian actors can do that. But then the next step is, what can humanitarian actors do to lay the groundwork for future development that begins to get at those root causes? And if that's going to happen, we have to begin that conversation about how can humanitarian actors start to do things to address the conflict in a way where they're comfortable, but where they are still putting a toe in the water that is looking a little bit political.
If I may, without violating the rules of procedure here, by chairs commenting on things that have been said by the group and speaking somewhat on behalf of the humanitarians in the room, maybe. a couple of observations. A year ago at the World Humanitarian Summit, there was a lot of talk about resilience. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the sort of traditional or Dunantist school of thought in the humanitarian world was a little bit freaked out, because it was like people said, oh, the development scent has landed in humanitarian world. Actually, I think the more thoughtful people were not so worried about the resilience agenda in terms of root causes as they were in terms of thinking about conflict the same way we think about things like drought or floods or price shocks or what have you. In other words, the last thing any humanitarian would want would be for people to become resilient to repeated violations of international humanitarian law. That's ridiculous. The idea is stop those violations of international humanitarian law. And that does get to root causes, and it does get to things that maybe aren't necessarily in the humanitarian skill set. But a couple of years ago, we conducted a study that was actually commissioned by OFDA on disaster risk reduction, because OFDA at the time was trying to figure out where the limits of its mandate were, and you know, the development side of the house kicked in, so to speak. And being slightly cheeky about it, we decided to include one case study where the risk was conflict. So we were looking at the post-election violence in Kenya in 2007-2008, and all of the myriad of things that were going on in 2011-2012-13 to prevent a repeat of that violence. Interestingly, what we and our partner in this study was an organization called the Nairobi Peace Initiative, and the Kenya Red Cross, which is about as diverse a crowd as you can get to talk about peace building. But interestingly, at the end of the day, even though we had a lot of discussions about neutrality and about the extent to which humanitarian actors engage in political things, actually the skill sets and the kinds of values that were required weren't very different. In other words, what looks like neutrality to a humanitarian looks pretty closely to what, you know, being an honest broker looks like to a peace builder. So in many ways, I think that there actually are ways to work at this beyond, you know, I mean, conflict sensitivity and programming and all those kind of things I think is an important element. But I think there are other elements where perhaps the gulf, if you will, isn't as wide as it looks like, but we're looking at it from the wrong angle. Okay, so no more. I will self-censor now. Chris, and then in the back corner, Keith.
Hi, Keith, George, Washington University. I wanted to push back a little bit about the opening comment around resilience building measures and not necessarily always addressing perhaps fragility and conflict. Because I think that in a way, resilience programming takes into consideration conflict, right? I think that if we were thinking about sectoral interventions before all of this, I would tend to say perhaps that was left out of the equation, but in a way I'm hopeful that a decade into thinking about resilience-based programming, that in, you know, the context of Yemen and elsewhere, that when we evaluate programs, we design programs, whether it's nutrition or WASH, that it takes in that conflict lens. Second comment would be that I hadn't heard today a discussion around youth development, adolescent development, where, again, thinking about fragility and points of intervention, it's critical that becomes a priority. And really, as a former often director, I would push some of my colleagues in this room to pay more attention around youth development, and also perhaps stop being so afraid of investing in education within these contexts, because we really do need to do more. It's not development, it's really around risk reduction. It's so imperative that this becomes part of its humanitarian.
Hi, Chris Barrett from Cornell University. The psychology and behavioral economics literatures are increasingly established some pretty significant effects of exposure to conflict, whether it's directly suffering violence or just being present to and witnessing violence or being threatened by violence in your community. There's a pretty good body of evidence now showing durable mental health effects of that, effects on what we economists think of as the primitives, risk preferences, time preferences, et cetera. And I'm curious to hear your reflections on what sort of programming you're aware of that's trying to address buffering people against some of those effects, and the extent to which, insofar as you try to measure resilience, like Luca, you know, the FAO team has a whole apparatus, but these are unobservables. You know, they're not, as I understand it, built into REMA. And yet they're perhaps the most damaging, lasting consequences of violence. Can you offer some reflections on how we as a community ought to be grappling with dealing with these mental health and psychological effects and measuring them as we try to establish whether we're actually building resilience?
Any other questions? Those are two kind of biggies. Okay, one here in the front, please.
I would like our panelists to share their view on the perception that people are less likely to engage in conflict if they have a lot to lose. From your experience, is that the case?
Thanks. And can you also introduce yourself?
I'm Joseph Bonnington. I'm a full security advisor at International Medical Corps.
Thank you. John, no, you might be able to address the youth development issue, but please, anyone?
I'll take a stab at that one and then see if I can actually respond to Chris's comment too, because we've looked at certain things. We have looked at some of the exposure to violence and trauma, most as it relates to young people. So let me start with Chris's and then Keith, see if I can end up doing justice to yours. So in addition to having mental health effects, exposure to conflict, there's also some evidence pointing to it begetting more conflict, whether that's, you know, growing up in the situation of domestic violence and becoming violent yourself, or if it's political violence, further perpetuating more political violence. So there's a lot of reasons to intervene upstream there or catch trauma early on. So that's sort of the psychosocial resilience world, which is probably more developed, to be honest, than the humanitarian development resilience world. Although if we kind of look at it somewhat separately, at least in my organization, because it's much more on an individual level. But the interventions are, things that are like safe spaces, sort of a big protection element. There's a lot of psychosocial curricula. But the interesting part, we've been able to look at some of those pretty rigorously and look at some observable outcomes, not just sort of self-reported mental health, but looking at, for example, in Jordan among Syrian refugees, cortisol levels to actually measure stress, which is, you know, a sort of a feature of mental health, immunity levels and things like that. So there's really strong evidence there. I think the next question is, you know, how does that, if it has longer term effects on young people's abilities to learn, to engage in livelihoods, to resist sort of risky behaviors, those kinds of things. But that's a super interesting field. And I guess just to tie to Key's point, I think the best answer I can give on the youth development side is, you know, right now I think there's a lot of programming that's trying to geared towards reducing the risk of young people's engagement in violence. And some big assumptions behind that in terms of let's keep them busy, let's keep them employed, let's keep them in school, which all have, you know, merit and efficacy under certain conditions depending on the violence and the drivers we're talking about. But back to the original points, I mean, from our research, and I'll look at some of the things that we've done in Mali and northeastern Nigeria around some of those armed opposition groups, you know, time and time again we see it coming back to an issue of governance-related grievances. So it's really not about the economics. It's less about identity, and it's much more about being exposed to injustice and corruption and disenfranchised. And so I think that kind of pushes us back into where we started with Joe and Dan's points of really working on that side of the equation.
I guess just on the pushback, I welcome that pushback. And I really want to be wrong about resilience programming in general. The point I had made just was that resilience programming that is disconnected or not accounting for conflict and fragility dynamics has very little potential to make an improvement in the kinds of things that will contribute to future violence. And so no doubt where resilience programming is in fact properly accounting for all that, and if it's true that lots of resilience programming out there is more and more doing that, that's all good. But the point is that when we disregard it, we do so at our own risk. And so I welcome the development that more and more resilience programming is accounting for conflict. That's great. That's exactly the right direction we should be going in. And I'll leave it at that.
You want to address a question about...
Well, there were a couple of points. The point raised by Chris about how you factor in issues of the psychological effects of conflict on resilience in the analysis is clear. That you mentioned RIMA. RIMA is not doing this thing, and it will never do it, because, I mean, we should not overcharge a tool with something which it cannot do. So most probably one of the things that we are trying to do is to try how we can complement an analysis which is essentially based on access to basic assets, service, and so on with other factors. My colleague Marco De Rico in the parallel session is talking about people aspiration, how we can include this into an econometric model. So we are not there, and I don't think we can stretch the tool beyond these things. About people, they have a lot to lose. They don't engage in conflict. And that is most probably true. In fact, most probably, and when you come to, we look at this in northern Mali, people that enter into extremism are essentially youth, as Key said it, for which the opportunity cost of entering into terrorism movement are very high. So it's because they have very little to lose. So there is an element of truth in this.
Okay, we are all but out of time, and we are under strict orders to let everybody get on to the next session in good time. So maybe I would ask each of the panelists if you have one sort of parting or takeaway thought for the group here, and then we will break up. Takeaway thought?
Yeah. Okay, sir?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Okay, let me just give you say something still under an FAO perspective. We are publishing now, since 2 years, a report which is called the Global Report on Food Crisis. And the number of severely food insecure people in the world in terms of acute food insecurity has risen from 80 million to 108 million in the last year. This is essentially due to conflict and partly to El Nino phenomenon. Out of the 13 major food crises in the world, 10 out of 13 are due to conflict. So while conflict 20 years ago was an exception, now it has become the norm. So this forced an organization like FAO to equip ourselves with different tools and really to be able to work in this kind of conflict situation. So we are struggling at the moment, but it's a strategic priority for the organization, equipping ourselves to be able to use agriculture in a conflict sensitive manner in contexts like the one we mentioned today.
Thanks. Joe?
I guess I will close with this. I mean, it's come up a couple times. Is conflict like other shocks? And I think we all agree it's not. It's man-made. It's human-made. And because of that, the potential exists for people to manipulate the risks of it happening. And, you know, Courtney earlier had said, it's complicated. The root causes are difficult to get at, and is there really any chance? What can we really do to manipulate these risks of conflict breaking out? But the good news is that we're starting to develop a bedrock of evidence about some things that work, and it's going to serve us well as a community, whether we're peace builders or people who do resilience programming, to become more and more familiar with that. And so what I would say in closing is that there's a fantastic report that just came out of a collaboration with the World Bank and the UN that was released at UNGA last week or week before last, summarizing everything we know about conflict prevention at this point. And it's really, it's gratifying to look at it because there really is a lot that we are now doing that is successful. And so let's just remember that this is work that we can, unlike the risk of a natural disaster happening, the risk of a conflict happening is something we really can make a difference with. And we're getting good at it, and the evidence exists that we're starting to make a difference.
Okay, John, real quick.
Yeah, mine is just a reflection on who's in the room. I think a lot of our points here are what I come around to understanding is, we really are dependent on the conflict management peace building field, which has decades worth of experience, theories and literature behind it. And so while we're trying to program around some of those, like contact theory in South Sudan, we would do well to draw on more of the people like Joe into some of these discussions that really revolve around livelihood resilience.
Great, thanks. Mm-hmm.